Thanks, Jim. Thanks for hosting. Thank you. It's an honor and privilege to talk and do service. Thank you very much. Good morning, men. My name is Wes Fritz, and I'm an alcoholic. Mark Fisher, thank you for turning the lights on. Gentlemen, I live in Michigan here in Detroit, and I grew up in a small town in southwest Detroit. And I was the youngest of three. And my sister was the oldest. And I had to live with an active alcoholic, and it was my father. I lived in fear for a long time, and I mean for 29 years. It took me 29 years to get here, and but a lot of things happened in my youth. One of the first things that happened when I was in third grade. I was like 7 years old. I was playing, it's called 500 baseball. You totally pop up, it's 100 points. And I'm talking about a group of guys, a group of kids that hung out all the time, like 30 of us. And I ran in front of this guy and I caught this ball, and he got pissed off and he hit me in the stomach and knocked the wind out of me, and naturally I ran home crying. But the crazy thing is, when I went to the bathroom, I was pissing blood. And I called my mom. My mom was a bus driver then. Naturally, well, wait till I get home. I want to see. I want to see, not that she didn't believe me, but, then we had to go over and see Dad. Dad was always at the bar. He was a truck driver. And I ended up in the hospital for, I don't know, 6 to 7 weeks. I was born, I found out through the accident, I was born without a uterus tube from my bladder to my one kidney. And they had to fix that. And I remember they used to have to put them vial tubes, tape them to my like a crib back then, a metal crib bed. And watching my urine and see if it clears up. And I had bad ideas right out of bed, right out of the start, man. I took one of the tubes, I got one and I filled it with water. And I taped it to the bed, so naturally they took that one and they took it down and they tested it. And they found out it was water. And I remember. And that was the first time, I really tried to escape, reality, because I had so much fear of being left alone, but I was held back in third grade because I missed too much school, that surgery was a long recovery. So that was like third and fourth grade. Fourth grade I started playing basketball with the sixth graders. I loved sports. I loved the freedom of being athletic, and I didn't even know what an athlete was, but it seemed funny that they always used me for an example, because I stood out in front of everybody. I was a tall, slim kid, fast. I got involved in football after my surgery when I was eight. I wanted to kick, pass, and punt, and I traveled, and that was pretty cool, back in them days. I took my first drink. When I was 8 years old, I took it with my brother. My mom and my aunt went into this liquor store, you know, and me and my brother were in the back of this. I remember it like yesterday, man. It was a 1968 two-door Cadillac. And I mean, really fine looking interior, you know. And anyways, they came out with a bag and something, I don't know. They forgot something. So they went back in, and me and my brother opened this bag, and here's two bottles. One was a bottle of Boone's Farm wine, and the other one was Cold Duck. And I think Cold Duck was champagne. And by the time my mom got back, those bottles were back in the bag, empty. And I got in trouble for that. I got grounded to the backyard. But that backyard, man, I was like on a Ferris wheel, man, running around the yard, man, just like I was floating, you know, just like woo, you know. Needless to say that I didn't know that that was the wrong thing to do. And then you know, here at local, we had the woods down by the Rouge River, which runs through the canal of the Detroit River, and by the Ford Motor Company. And we used to make forts down there, you know. And one kid one day he stole a bottle of MD 2020, you know, and we drank that. And man, it was good. You know, it was a lot better than that Boone's Farm wine. You know, so I went to that store where he got it at, Sibs Party Store here, and it's no longer here. But and that bottle of MD 2020 was like at my waist, pocket high, you know, and it was so easy to stick that half of a pint in my pocket, you know, and walk out. And but I remember getting sick. Oh my God, I drank that thing and I got sick, so sick, man. It was unbelievable. But yet I kept on going. By the time I got to seventh grade, our schools separated. All the seventh graders went to were from five different schools, and we all came together. And I'd never seen these kids in my life before. And you know, and again, I was an athlete. And you know, like they say back in the day, you know, the jocks and the burnouts, and it was funny how I attached to the burnouts. 6:30 in the morning every morning. You smoke a joint. And I mean every day, you know. I was like 13 years old, you know, and I remember Mr. Fluharty was his name. It was our principal. And he called me out of a class, and I can't, and I know now today, you know, back then when I was 13, because I tried to hide everything. But where we did this at was on a back porch of the school, between the school and the football field. Well, there was a little square hole in the door, and he could see us, but we couldn't see him. And he called me out of this class, and he grabbed me, man, by my chest, grabbed me, and he like threw me up against the lockers, and he's like, "What the heck do you think you're doing?" You know, and I had no clue what he was talking about. "You're gonna screw up your life. You're gonna, you know," he didn't mention marijuana or anything. You know, he just put it out there, and it just went boom right over my head, you know. But the days that Dad come home, and like I said, I was the youngest. Mom would take me, and he would make the phone call, but just like I did, and never come home. when the bars closed, he was on his way, you know, you knew that. And I remember in 1976, he bought a brand new F-150 with a camper on it, parked it in the backyard, and we never used it. And me and mom used to use it for a hiding spot until, you know, the next morning. At least we could sleep in there and we wouldn't have to listen to him yelling and screaming at my mom, you know. And all the shit that she put up with that man, I don't understand that. But anyways, I was always in fear. I was always scared. So by the time I was 13, 14 years old, I would always ask a friend, a couple of friends, if I couldn't spend a night somewhere, I'd ask another guy to spend a night, especially on the weekends, because I knew it was going to happen, you know. And the crazy thing about it is it's like when it happened, the next day it was like nothing happened. It was never brought up. You know, it was never talked about. It was stuffed, you know, and guess what? I learned how to stuff wrong things that I did. Whether I stole, whether I cheated, you know, I robbed, you know, and but that helped me, you know, to keep things quiet, you know. Even in this program, when I got here, when I was 29 years old, you know, I just learned how to stuff shit and just forget about it, you know. But when I was 14, we were at the dinner table one night, and my youth dog died, had a seizure right there at the dinner table. You know, it was a sad, horrible thing, you know. I mean, it just didn't have a chance. And the next day, you know, I go to school and I go to basketball practice. Now, remind you, I'm already a captain. I'm a captain on Little League football, was the captain, and basketball was a captain, and baseball was the captain. And I always was the leader. Always, you know, because I like I said before, I stood out very young and I had talent. You know, I threw a one hitter when I was 8 years old, you know, and but when my dog died and I went to basketball practice the next day, my coach walked up to me and he says, "If you can't give 100%, go on home." A 14-year-old kid, you tell him that, and like, didn't ask why or anything. I went to the locker room, and he come in there, and he's like, "What are you doing?" He says, "You know, you're going home?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm going home." I says, "You know," and he grabbed me, and it just got worse. "You're not going home, you know," and this and that. I said, "Leave me alone and don't touch me, okay?" So that was the end of my career of basketball in eighth grade. And let's see, eighth grade, I was 15 until I was probably 30, 31 when I did my first inventory. I finally realized what I did. You know, I thought I was trying to help myself, but I didn't. I abandoned the basketball team. I let go of all them kids I played ball with, you know. But I still played football and baseball, you know. I hated school, and the only reason why I went to school is to play football and baseball, you know. And I got my first drunk driving in 1984, 22 years old, right here in town. I got in a fight with my brother at home, and I couldn't do anything. I had a towel around me and my sister was standing there, so I couldn't do anything. So I was so angry, I went to the bar. And I could get in any bar at a young before I was able to drink. And I drank 22 shots of ginger brandy in 15 minutes. And a friend of mine walked in the bar and I said, "Hey man, you got any weed?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Let's go smoke a joint." So I got in my mom's car and I went down this alley. I took a 100-foot of fence out. You know, he's like, "What's wrong with you, man?" So I turned and the first residential street I came to, the first car that went by was a one of them neighborhood watch cars. So I like skidded on the rocks, preventing it to hit him. But once they turned, I took off and I went right by and right through a block before a main intersection in our city. I hit a lady. I hit that lady three times because I was stuck. I couldn't get my car off. And I ended up getting unstuck, and Steve was with me. And I said, "You all right?" And he said, "Yeah." I said, "Get out of my car." I took off, went down a block and over three blocks and parked it and actually walked right by the accident. But that wasn't enough, guys. That wasn't enough. 22 years old and I already had my first drunk driving. You know, and so I swung a hammer in Ann Arbor building houses and I got a drunk that drunk driving and I come home and I had to change. I had to do something different. Well, 1984 is when I met the girl that I married. She had four kids. And my next job was a bartender. You know, and I couldn't drink at the bar though. If I was working, I couldn't drink. And that was a good thing. But it wasn't just enough money. You know, I just felt, you know, I mean, you know, she lost her husband 3 years before I met her of leukemia. And she had these four kids. And I felt the selfishness then that I just wasn't given enough. I wasn't doing enough. So I got this job being an exterminator. And as an exterminator in our wonderful city of Detroit, and it was awful, you know, it was terrible. And I got off that job and I ended up going back to a little bit of carpentry. And I got in a little trouble, domestic, not domestic, I should say, you know, I got in a big bar fight. And I got in a little trouble with assault and battery. Well, I quit that exterminating job and I ended up going in a different bar and next thing you know I'm getting another bartending job, but this one I could drink at, you know. And I was the kid that got me the job I went to school with, you know, and the next thing you know I got the keys and I got control of everything, you know. And I almost killed myself by drinking and drugging. I'll just put it that way. I did it for a year and a half. I was down to 160 pounds. You know, nosebleeds, appendicitis, just some crazy shit, you know. And the guy was pretty good to me, you know. He helped me try to get my first house and didn't happen. You know, so I ended up I got my second offense of drunk driving in May 11th, 1990. And you know, a lot of things happened, guys. Here I am back in jail again, same city, same cell. And I was crazy. I on the back of the stainless steel toilet, there was a fountain, and naturally I drinking some water, and I stuck something in there, and to keep the water getting colder to splash on me to get sober, and no, it didn't work, so I'm sitting at a table bolted to the wall, and I'm just rocking back and forth, man. And the cop walked up to the door, he's like, "Hey, turn that water off, man, and I'm ignoring him, man. I'm over here at Henry Ford Mansion at the waterfalls, man, partying, just in a complete blackout, doing putting myself somewhere else besides in jail. And he's pounding on the door. Finally he left, He comes back, there's six more cops. And this time they opened the door, and I'm still sitting there rocking, and an officer's back, come in, and he says, "Did this officer ask you to turn this water off?" And I mean, just like nothing, you guys, just like when you hit this key on this computer, I didn't jump up or anything. I just looked right at him in his face, and I told him, I said, "I tell you exactly what I told him. You want that water off, you go over there and turn that off. But not in English, in street talk, okay? I don't want to blow this up." But anyway, so honestly, God, man, I still today can't understand why none of them touched me. You don't belong in here. You belong in a drunk tank. And the last drunk tank I was in, it was Fortin Greene down there in Detroit. And that was a crazy, stupid thing I got involved in. But they walked me down. The first time when I graduated, I met Larry Holmes, and he was in his per cage, all his bodyguards around him. And that's what it felt like, all these cops. I felt like, they're escorting me to this holding cell. So I go in this holding cell, and it's all marble and concrete. And it's probably 40 by 30. And over here to my right was a toilet and a concrete privacy wall and a sink. So I'm sitting, and I'm getting back into this rocking again on the floor, and I just lost it. I completely lost it. I took my jeans off, and I grabbed them in the crotch, and I ripped them in half, and I wrapped my hands, and I started beating on this cinder block wall. Well, I ended up breaking it, and it made me even angrier. So then I went over and I slammed down the sink, and the sink fell off the wall. Well, then it's like, I gotta get rid of this shit, these pants I got on my hands. So I broke the toilet, pulled the toilet right out of the floor, and I stuffed all my shit down that hole, because it stunk, A lot of things happened that day. And I end up getting out of jail, and my wife today brought me some clothes. And I mean, I was just so depressed. So what do I do? Where do I go? I need help. I need help. So I go to the nearest restaurant, and I start drinking coffee, and I couldn't stop crying, man. I cried for 3.5 hours. The waitress asked, "Are you okay? Is there anything I can do for you? Coffee. Give me coffee." So I go back to the cop shop, and I ask for my truck back, and they said no. So I had to go out to Ann Arbor and tell my boss I got a drunk driving. And I need a check, get my truck out of the pound. So by the time I come back to Ann Arbor, I go back to the cop shop. Well, you know where it, you know where your truck is. So I walk back there, you know, on the police in the pound, and here's all these vehicles show. And I had a red Chevy 79 three-quarter ton. And there was this other white truck in there. And it stuck out more than anything in that whole junkyard. You could tell that the jaws of life had ripped over the side door, and they cut the top of the back of the window, and they just bent the hood of the top of the truck open to get the person out of there. And whoever, I have no clue. I can't name him. I never heard him before, but he was right here. And he told me, he says, "You keep doing what you're doing, you're going to end up like this." It scared the hell out of me. So a cop comes and he says, "You know where your truck is?" I said, "Yeah, here's your keys." They got my truck. I went right to the bar because I was drinking with my coaches that night, the night before. You know, the old pat on the back, "It's going to be okay. Don't worry, da, 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 da," right? I bought a beer. I took a sip, and I just broke out crying. I just left. I went home. And I don't know today. I can't answer the question again. I'm sitting at home, you know, not knowing who to call, who to ask for help. I called the cops. I called the police again. I said, "Look, man, you guys arrested me last night for drunk driving." I said, "I'm going to do it again. I've already been back to the bar, and it's not hurt. I am hurt. I need some help, and I don't want to do what I did last night. Can you help me?" He says, "You ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous?" I said, "No." He says, "You know, we got a hotline number you can call it." I said, "Okay." So he gave me the hotline number. I called it. And a guy named Dick Lord answered it. I met him afterwards. And I explained to him what happened. And he asked me, he says, "Wes, you know where Cabrini High School is?" I said, "Yeah." And it's in Allen Park, the same city I got arrested in. It's a Catholic, school. He says, "Right next door to the church, there's a monastery building, the Holy Family House." He says, "Go into that front door and tell him that, he told me three things. He said, ask for the chairperson, ask for the first step, and get a sponsor." And that's what I did. 6 hours after I got out of jail. That was May 11th. Well, that was May 11th, 1990. Now, I lost a year. I gave a year away because I smoked a joint, one joint, and I didn't know that it did not say in anything that I heard read that you can't smoke weed or anything. And so I won't go there, but I'll just say this much. I told my sponsor, I says, "What I'll do is I'll go to Narcotics Anonymous for a year." You know, and what made me feel good is to get them key chains, you know. You get all them nice color key chains for every month you stay clean. Well, then I, no, go lay down, right? Then I went to a convention in NA down in Detroit, and I was on one of the bottle boats, which is, they're no longer here. I think one of them's in New York, but it's a paddle boat, you know, hold about 3,000 people, one of them would. But anyways, there were 1,700 addicts on that boat. And this convention I went to was just unbelievable. And, it helped me, you know. And once I got my year, I thanked them. And I said, I'm going back to AA. And so my sobriety day is May 11th, 1991. And I've been here ever since. I've had some wonderful friends, sponsors, home groups, service work that just, unbelievable. This COVID, this COVID just has done wonderful things for a lot of people, and I lost a lot of good men and women. But I was working the hotline, and I remember sitting in the bar, looking between the bottles in the mirror, saying, well, here comes the Harley pulling up, one of these days I'm gonna get me a, the liquid wishes, and I ended up getting one because I joined the Sober Riders. It was a sober motorcycle club out of West Lyon, Michigan. It was an MC club too, until I won't go into that. It's just not part of my story. But I ended up getting a good job, and I had to leave the club. But we went everywhere, and my wife and I rode everywhere. And then I got involved in construction. I got this job through the program, and the program has helped me everywhere in my life. And what's hard for me is to keep it simple. That's the hardest thing for me to do. Keep it simple. And a lot of people used to say, keep it simple, stupid. And it's like, okay, and I won't hit you. I got it once. I don't need it again. But the last couple days, last night, man, I heard a great guy speak. And I married this woman with four kids, and these four kids, just unbelievable, man. I did not do anything really to put them where they are today. Three out of the four are successful, very, very successful. One's real high up in boards. The other one's a vice president of a company where he started when he was 14, stuffing envelopes. The other one was a stay-at-home mom and raised three kids. And so those four kids gave me 14 grandkids. My oldest son is one of us. And losing your father at a young age, I can understand, but he doesn't understand that we can help him. I've taken him to meetings. You go sit over there by that guy. I know he's scared. The only time you hear about him is he's either in jail or in the hospital. And but anyways, those 14 grandkids, I know y'all know about my accident. 25 years sober. The night after, or the day after I was working in the hotline, I got in a motorcycle accident. A guy lost the ladder on a freeway, and I hit it. It killed me. It brought me back. And I know why God brought me back. I got four beautiful, beautiful great grandkids today. And as soon as I get off of here, I'm gonna help the wife. I've already started. My oldest grandson has invited us out to his mother's house to have a barbecue. And he just moved out of the house like 6 months ago. He's 27 years old. He's an apprentice, electrician apprentice. All of my grandkids are very successful. My one granddaughter and another family just got her pin for nursing, you know. I mean, and but I think I got time here. I got a better story. The better story is a drunk who fell in a hole. A drunk fell in a hole and couldn't get out. A businessman went by. The drunk called out for help. The businessman threw him some money and told him, "Get yourself a ladder." But the drunk could not find a ladder in the hole he was in. A doctor walked by. The drunk said, "Help, I can't get out." The doctor gave him some drugs and said, "Take these, it will relieve the pain." The drunk said, "Thanks." But when he took the pills, when he ran out, he was still in the hole. A renowned psychiatrist rode by and heard the drunk crying for him for help. He stopped and said, How did you get there? Where were you born? Where were you put by your parents? Tell me about yourself. It was evident that your sense of loneliness. So the drunk talked with him for an hour, then the psychiatrist had to leave. But he said he'd be back next week. The drunk thanked him, but he's still in the hole. A priest came by and told the drunk, called out for help. The priest gave him a Bible and said, I'll say a prayer for you. And he got down on his knees and prayed for the drunk, then left. The drunk was very grateful. He read the Bible, but he was still stuck in the hole. A recovering alcoholic happened to pass by, and the drunk cried out, "Help me. I'm stuck in this hole." Right away, the recovering alcoholic jumped in the hole with him. The drunk said, "What are you doing? Now we're both stuck here." But the recovering alcoholic said, "It's okay. I've been here before. And now we can get out." Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much. I really appreciate this meeting.